I'm Jenny Galluzzo, co-founder of The Second Shift. Welcome to our podcast where we talk all things women, work, and well-being, how they intersect, our competing forces, and how to create and maintain personal and professional alignment in your life. Let's do this. Sometimes people set a big goal. They've got something that they want to achieve, and you get started and there's a lot of momentum, but then you get stuck because there's so many steps and it's so hard and it's just, you lose that momentum. I do this all the time. Then you get stuck in that middle and it's very hard to achieve the goal that you want. And I find that if you still set a big goal, but you really break down that goal into granular, itty bitty steps, it's much easier to mentally focus on this tiny step, moving forward one thing after the next thing after the next thing, and watch that progress over time towards this goal than it is to look at this giant leap that you have to make in your life to achieve something that you want to do, and then talk yourself out of it. It's just, it's really easy to self-sabotage, to get lost along the way, to let everything else become a priority. And I'm a fan of this concept of like these baby steps. And I was put in touch with two women, Raisa Lewis and Adara Landry, who are both doctors. Like they're both emergency room doctors. They also write about workplace issues, and they've written a book called Micro Skills, Small Action, Big Impact. And it's really going through a list of things that you can set a goal for, and then what are the micro skills that you can do to get to that goal. And they have a whole prescription. Oh my God, that was a good doctor pun. Of how to achieve whatever goal you may set for yourself or the specific goals that they outline in the book, whether it's like a task list or becoming an expert in something or a better communicator or a better networker. They have a whole list of things and how you can get to that goal. And then that can be applied to anything. They are remarkable women. And I think that this is a great way to look at anything that you want to do, from I want to have a new job to I'm moving. Like anything that just seems like an overwhelming goal or achievement, or even just, I guess it doesn't even have to be that overwhelming. It could be a habit. I want to learn how to play tennis. You know, instead of thinking about, oh, it's going to take forever and I'm never going to be able to do it, and how am I going to put this into my life? It's like, just like do it this week. You know, what's the micro skill that you need to know how to do? How do you put it in place so you can build it into your life? I'm trying to implement this into my own life, and I think it's a very helpful way to think about attacking goals in your life. You are both doctors, professors, and now you have written this book and you write about workplace issues. So your workplace is very different than maybe many of the women that we work with, where they're in a corporate environment or they're working as consultants. So how did this book come about? How did you guys team up? And you have a podcast. Like, how did you team up to take on this subject matter outside of what you're doing in your day-to-day profession?
That's a great question. I'll start, and I know Risa's going to have something to add. Even though we work in a clinical setting and our primary objective is to take care of patients, you know, in a collaborative manner, we still work in a workplace where there is an environment and a culture and personalities and conflicts and communication needs, like all of those massive major themes that we experience in the hospital. We felt, we know that people in different environments, different working environments, also contend with. And so when Risa and I first started writing together, that was in 2020, we started to write about things that we were doing on a high level, like mentoring, but we knew that mentoring is something that people do in all fields. And we felt like, because of the fact that we are physicians, we know how to write, we know how to communicate, and we know how to mentor, we felt like we could write about the topic, but we wanted to challenge ourselves and write about it for a larger audience. So that's why we went with our one of our earliest pieces, our earliest articles was on being efficient with mentoring, and that went into Harvard Business Review.
I get what you're saying. So even though this isn't necessarily your occupation on a day-to-day level and your, you know, degree that's hanging on the wall, you work in the real world, in an organization with other people. It's just remarkable to me that you found the time, energy, and focus to still think about those bigger issues, to be interested in them, and then to do something about it. All the women who we work with are people who are showing up as their best and strongest selves. They are women who have first, second, third shifts, are so ambitious, are so powerful. That's why I'm praising you for it, and because you're showing that it's possible.
If I can launch off what you just shared, and you know, we're so appreciative for the invitation to be speaking with you, and your podcast, The Second Shift, spoke strongly to us because we actually refer to that in the book. We talk about it a lot. And we want to break down that perception that medicine, healthcare, doctors are so different, because what we've learned by writing together and by putting this book out into the world is what happens in our workplace, what happens in our industry, in our organization, in our hospital is very similar to what happens for many people in whatever the industry, whatever the workplace. And so part of our success publishing in, for example, Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, it was proof of concept. It says that, yep, what we're writing about, what we experience in the workplace is translatable across industries, across people's identities. It speaks to everybody. So one of the things we emphasize with the book is this is a book for everybody to help be better at work, to help prioritize belonging at work, and to help be better at work.
I love it.
And Ginny, I wanted to add to your comment about us doing a lot. We get that often, like especially I feel like I get it from my own personal experience, because when people find out that I am a physician, I have a nonprofit, I'm writing a book, and I have three kids, they say, how are you able to do that? And I know Risa has her own very long list of things that she's managing as well. And the most fundamental thing is that I have created very strict boundaries. So I'm really good at protecting my time and resting properly so that when I go back into my first shift or my second shift, whenever I feel like I need to work, I am really focused, I'm restored. And so I block off, you know, 6 to 9 p.m. Almost every night. And there's a story in the book as far as why I do that, but I block that off because I think it's important for me to be with my family, to eat a good meal, to clean my house. And, you know, that was my first step. And then I started blocking off weekends. But by doing this stuff very strategically and very small actions, it's made like a huge impact in how I think about work and how quickly I'm able to get things done.
In the book, Adair and I talk about three truths. And one truth that ties into what we've spoken about so far is that time can only be spent. So we really emphasize this concept of time as currency. You can't put it in a savings account. It can only be spent. So people should be thoughtful, intentional about how they spend their time, where they spend their time, with whom they spend their time.
One of the things, and coming off of what you're saying, I'm a big believer that like time is expandable, and that if you create those boundaries, if you create the prioritization, if you figure out what your goals are, your life will expand to figure out how to make those things happen in it. And a lot of times I find people talk themselves out of doing things because it's very easy to say, I don't have the time. That's, you know, you're a busy working mother, this thing or that thing. So one of the reasons why I was highlighting all the things you do is because it shows that it's a possibility. So you don't have to, that is an excuse that doesn't work. There isn't anybody who's so busy they can't do something, that a goal, reach a goal, do something that if you put the micro skills into place and you prioritize and you create the boundaries around what you want to do so you can achieve that goal, you can do anything you want.
To flip that thought on its side, actually upside down, we agree. And to that end, if you think about the example of a meeting, everybody thinks a meeting has to be an hour. What about actually probably because meetings expand to fit the time allotted, probably a lot of 60-minute meetings could be 30-minute meetings. A lot of 30-minute meetings could be 15 or 20-minute meetings. A lot of 15 or 20-minute meetings could be a text or a phone call. So yes, we really think people need to be thoughtful about time.
Can I speak about the evenings though a little bit? Because I am in so many mom circles, and I can say that that is when most of us feel extremely exhausted and behind, and that's when we need the most help. And there's a lot of statistics about there about how this is a gendered burden, and how a lot of the overtime work, all of this work done at home, falls on if, you know, and depending on the dynamic of the family, the mother, if one is present. And so for me, what I have done, again, a stepwise fashion, is I have thought about all of the stuff that I have, because a lot of the stress in my life is surrounded by stuff. Sometimes it's physical objects, sometimes it's obligations and responsibilities. And I really try to trim those without guilt, because my high level thought is my family is going to be better off if I am less stressed. And I had the philosophy of my family's better off if I keep putting stuff on my plate to do for them, right? Like, my kids need to have the best birthday party. And in the end, I was stressed about planning for it because I had to invite all these people. I put this like obligation to have the best decoration, like all these things made it actually a very stressful event for me. So I've really changed my philosophy on how I approach just the tasks in my life. And, you know, from having less toys, like all my toys are stored in the basement and my kids get a box of toys for the week. And at the end of the week, they pack those toys up and get a new box for the next week. So now when I clean up, it's like literally 10 minutes. Like, they don't need all of their toys upstairs or downstairs. Like, they don't need it. But that like small choice has saved me an hour. Like, I don't have to clean up toys every night for an hour. I bought one of those Roomba vacuums, so I don't have to vacuum my room or my house anymore at night. Like, all of these like small choices have made a huge impact in how much free time I have and how less I feel stressed in the evenings.
Those are good tips. That one with the toys, is, I really like that one. Let's talk about goal setting, because it's the beginning of the new year. And a lot of people set these big goals or even little goals. And you can get thwarted by your own self because it just seems too big. And once you get off the track, it's hard to get back on. So I think micro skills and the idea of breaking things down into small actions and small steps is such good advice, because small steps lead towards big goals.
Correct.
So how do you recommend that people do that? And what's the data behind it showing that success?
You're speaking our language, and we believe this as well, which is why we wrote this book. We've been there. Huge task, huge deadline, huge project, huge fill in the blank, huge habit that you want to take on. You're not sure where to start. And we learned this in medicine, but it actually preceded medicine. Think about learning how to tie your shoe. When, of course, I'm dating myself, but those of us that tied shoes as opposed to slip-ons or Velcro, there were a lot of steps to it. It was kind of complicated, you know, opening up the shoe, pulling out the tongue, slipping your foot in, tightening the laces, and then tying that shoe in a knot. That was hard, but many steps, step by step by step. Same concept in medicine. For example, if someone comes in, their heart is not working, they're in cardiac arrest, we have to do CPR and resuscitation. There's a step by step protocol and process as how that's done. So it comes very naturally now for us to think about things that way. And so we think this thought process and this approach is translatable. And so when we break things down into smaller steps, it's much more doable, much more digestible, incorporatable. And these little small steps, these micro skills, they translate. So you learn how to apply it, for example, in being a polished communicator. Next thing you know, you can use the same micro skill to figure out how to get promoted, figure out how to look for your next position. So they're not these isolated one-offs. They build upon each other, and you can translate them to other skills and big goals.
That's very true. Because once you've achieved one goal, it's very easy to set the next one. And I think of habits that way, especially because with habits, say you want to start an exercise routine, right? You want to start building that into your schedule. And you sign up and you're going to go every day, and then you don't, or it seems too big. But if you break it down and you say, I'm going to do something for 10 minutes, I'm going to put my shoes on and I'm going to go for a walk for 10 minutes. And you build into your life that routine and that habit of that 10 minutes. You've reached a goal. You feel so good. You have that endorphin rush. You want to build upon it. So I think what you're saying, the idea that one thing builds upon it itself, is very true. And have you seen that happen in your own life? And, or, you know, what examples do you use in the book of people who have successfully achieved a goal to build upon it for other things?
I'll give an example that comes to mind. There are many, many, many examples. The first one that came to mind for me is this concept of your board of directors. And one of the things that we come back to is when you're figuring out how to develop subject matter expertise, when you want to get feedback on a presentation, when you want to practice a difficult conversation, when you want to, and there's many, many, many more examples, one actual skill that we talk about, we call it a critical action, is to get your board of directors, have a table, a figurative table of people that sit at your board that you can call upon, people you trust, people that maybe at one point were a coach, but then they've become a mentor, they're a coach mentor, maybe they were a sponsor, maybe it's a friend from college, maybe it's a colleague who just has said, let me know when I can ever help you. Your board of directors are the people that you can call in case of emergency, so to speak, work emergency. So having that board of directors and thinking about that concept of your go-to people, that is something you can carry with you when you're developing any one of these skills.
I think for me, because of just the obligations I have with raising the kids, because it is a tremendous amount of work, the most fundamental thing that has helped me, the most fundamental skill I have learned is when to say no, when to quit, when to move on from something. I will say that when I came back from maternity leave for my third, I had 3 academic titles, like positions, and I had some smaller roles and responsibilities. And I think I was still like just starting the nonprofit. Plus I had 3 kids. And so it was incredibly time intensive. And it made me sit down and say, okay, you have to take control. And I actually went to my own personal board of directors and I asked a lot of folks and they said, you have to say no to things and quit. So for me, I would say recognizing that quitting is not a sign of being a failure or it's not a weakness. It's actually a strength and it's very strategic about when you do it and how you do it. So I would say learning that basic skill has helped me in so many ways because now when something comes my direction, I'm always thinking about the red flags early on. Like, why is this a bad idea? And what potentially could make this sort of be a waste of time? I'm also thinking about it from the good side too. Like, how can this help my career? Who will I impact if I do this work? Is this funded? Will I have support? I'm trying to figure out if this is really a good opportunity for me. And that is because I've really thought about all of the reasons why I have said no in the past. And I'm trying to avoid being in that same situation. And this applies to both work and home.
I think what is really interesting about what you're saying about is really prioritization, right? You're talking about saying no, feeling confident, taking accountability for all of the things that are in your life and figuring out how to make them all fit and without guilt.
So if we had written a book and we just say in the book, prioritize your tasks, spend more time thinking about how to prioritize your tasks, we know our readers would still wonder, like, how do you do that? And so that's why when Risa and I were writing this book, we first read a bunch of other books and we looked at what had been published previously. And what we found was that a lot of books leave readers with, you know, vague, lofty goals that might not have all of the exact steps laid out. And so our mission when we're writing this book was to be super granular. And so when we tell people how to create a task list, which is, as you're saying, creating a priority list, we're thinking about what do your supervisors expect of you and figuring that out. Determining the priority of the task, meaning does this need to be done now, later, or never? assessing the resources that you need and do you have them, setting realistic timelines, setting realistic due dates. So we go through like a long list of really small granular things that can help you decide if your task list is optimized or not.
I was going to ask off of this, and I'm really curious to know, what are the specific skills or habits that you've seen have like significant impact and what you really want to highlight for people who are listening? And, you know, obviously they should get the book and read the book so they get the entire scope, but what are the ones that you see really have the outsized impact?
Jenny, I'm glad to share, like in terms of our book, there are 10 chapters and each chapter covers a theme of a micro skill. And then underneath each chapter, we break it down and talk about specific micro skills to help build up to the greater micro skill. So for example, we have a chapter on micro skills for self-care. And within that, we talk to people about their board of directors. We talk about deliberate rest. We talk about getting on top of their personal finances. So that would be one chapter. We have another chapter on micro skills to manage a task list. Then micro skills for polished communication. So you can see these are skills that are translatable no matter where you work. Micro skills to build and maintain your reputation. Micro skills to becoming a subject matter expert, to learn your workplace culture, to be a team player, to grow your network, for navigating conflict, and finally, micro skills to actively find new opportunities.
What are the steps for finding new opportunities?
So we cover about 7. And, you know, I'll take one that really spoke to me or that I've used. Actually, everything we wrote about is based on Adara and my lived experience as physicians, as leaders, as educators, as authors, as entrepreneurs. You know, we've taken pieces of our lived experience to put this book together and to provide a reflection of our advice, but with references to support where we're coming from. And so in terms of actively finding new opportunities, one of the ones that I really like is our first one that we talk about, which is learning to transfer your skills. And I think sometimes if you're, and you talk about mid-career women being stuck.
The second shift is built on a skills-based algorithm, the matching algorithm, because we want people to really hone down what their skills are, not necessarily what their experience is. Like, what is it you do in that job? Not what is your job title?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that speaks to us. When I've been in periods personally of feeling stuck or feeling like, oh, I've not done anything. I can't believe I've come all this far and I've not done anything. I have nothing to show for my work. One of the things I tell people is like, pull out your resume or pull out your CV and just take a look at it. And then you're like, oh, okay. I've done some things like, or, oh, okay, I've done some training. So it's also a way to realize the skills that you have. One of the things I've learned that when I've moved jobs, when I've moved positions is sometimes you're not sure what you learned in the last job until you get to the new one. When you get to the new one, you're like, oh, I actually know how to network. Or I know how to cold call people and set up meetings. I know how to put together an essay. I know how to write a policy statement. I know how to write an opinion piece that I can submit for publication or for the company newsletter. So that concept of transferring skills starts with realizing and being able to name your skills.
I can give another one as far as learning your next opportunity, because I was in a point where I felt like I wanted to do something bigger and better. And so I applied for a position at Harvard Medical School. But the way this actually occurred was that a friend of mine sent me an email saying, hey, there's an opportunity, you should apply to this. And so when I read the description and the criteria, I said, oh, this sounds so amazing for me. But unfortunately, it asks for, I think it was like 8 years of experience or 5 years, I'm not so sure, but I fell 1 year, but 1 or 2 years beneath that criteria. And so my literal response was, I don't actually have the years. And I think they asked for assistant professor. And at that point, I was still an instructor, but I was very close to becoming an assistant. And so he just sent me a very quick email and he said, you have enough of the criteria, talk to your chair and you should still apply. And so if he hadn't replied to to me in that way, I would have certainly just deleted the email, never thought about it again, and moved on, because that's what I had sort of in my mindset until he had replied to me. So I did reach out to my chair and I said, I'm interested in this position. You know, they asked for 5 years. I'm at year four. They asked for me to be an assistant. I'm an instructor. And he's like, not a problem at all. You're ready for a promotion already. So why don't we just put you up and I'll fast track you so that they can quickly evaluate you. By the time this position is like confirmed for you, you'll be at that rank. And so a lot of this was just, again, having that initial nudge and being comfortable talking to your network and seeing what they can help you with. But the other part is just recognizing like, oh, wow, I actually don't need to meet all of the criteria for any particular position. I can just apply if I'm close enough or in range.
Both of those things that you just said are so relatable. And if you looked at you two and you looked at your resumes and the jobs and the things that you do, you would never assume that you would have doubts about your resume or think that you haven't done something or that you wouldn't be the shoo-in for the job. And it just goes to show that like everybody has the same fears, self-doubts, judgments. They say like women have to have like 100% of the qualifications to apply for a job where men have 60. Like this happens all the time. We see women who want to apply for something and they're like, well, I don't think. And then we're like, of course you should. What are you crazy? Just go for it. But it's such a common story. And I love the advice that you just gave and both of those examples so much. I think this book is going to be such a help for anybody who's at work or has a goal or wants to get back into work or wants to just do something new, get a new habit, get a new skill, and how to break it down to build it back up. So thank you. Thank you for sharing it. I think this is an incredible manual for achievement.
Thanks so much.
Thank you so much for joining the conversation. For more, you can follow along at thesecondshift.com. Please rate, review, subscribe, and help us make work work for you and for all women.